And I deserve today. And I think to me, it would be a useful thing to have an article in the Sunday Times magazine, which is read by about 5 million people. What your second prayer would be like? You might be interested to know what words going around New York after having described you as a fascist beast for 3.5 years. And now, actually, you've been a liberal for the last 3.5 years. But you're corrected. It seemed to me that, as you know, sir, there have only been two presidents since 1920 to be elected to a second term. And we don't know much what the modern presidency is like when a man has had his last election, as much you choose to agree with what John Quincy Adams did, which you may do, but they only got one. And you are quite free of the always compelling fact of elections coming up, and have learned what one learns in 4 years in the job, which is only safe to do that if you do. And I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about what you think. And let me say to you what I think, just as not to yatter at you, but I suppose to be fooled, I think, and I was going to. Is it all right with you if we do this article?
Sure.
And that I let them know at least this has been an interview with you. I said, I'm going to be interviewing some cousin. I said, I don't know how to do this. All I know is how to go in there and talk as fast as I can and as long as I can until they stop letting me watch.
So, I think you've got a problem on doing this an interview with the president because there aren't any interviews with the president.
Well, that's what I mean. I need to say that I think the way
I think you've got to do it is your own knowledge.
Phase two begins, and as I see it, that will be the next great see that that phase two develops a mutually beneficial, mutually one which both sides will have reasons to abide by, agreement limiting all nuclear offensive weapons. And that then leads to phase three, which we would trust would mean an eventual reduction on a mutual basis. See? Within all of this context, of course, then we have the other areas of the world. We have the enormous economic problems. What I mean is the economic monetary impacts and so forth. We talk about what experience matters. I would say that I knew very little about it when I first came to office. I know a great deal about it at the present time. The need to build a new economic structure in the world, I mean, in terms of trade, in terms of monetary affairs, etc. With the new common market, for example, that'll be the greatest trading unit in the world. The Soviet Union is becoming very important. In 25 years, China will be very important, not because there are 800 million of them, but because they're Chinese. And of course, the Japanese are to be a fantastically important force in the world. Now, for their benefit as well as ours, building a world order, as I indicated a moment ago, which from a military and diplomatic standpoint will avoid military collision, you have to build a world order which will provide for orderly economic competition on a constructive basis, but not economic destruction. Now, I've mentioned these fairly important areas. I do not overlook, of course, the underdeveloped world, so-called divisions in Africa, Latin America, and all the rest. I see what the promise is there. But there again, I use only these examples of the highest level to indicate that that's what we have to do, the same kind of energy has to go together. I mentioned the Mid-East only in passing by saying that it is after what Vietnam will be over, but after that, the Mid-East is a very great potential anchor spot. And it's going to take very skillful diplomacy to maintain, which must be maintained, the territorial, the independence, the integrity of Israel, at the same time have peace in the area.
Yeah.
So that's it. So much for the foreign policy area. Now, in order for the United States to be able to play that kind of a role in the world, and here is where I have a very basic in order for it to do it, the United States first has got to be strong militarily.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Of course, strong economically, and also strong in terms of its own spirit, self-respect. In other words, we've got to be able to govern ourselves if we're going to be able to make a contribution to the government of the world. So I will then come to your point. But looking, for example, at military strength, it is sheer madness to talk about like a little country like Israel, and say, well, if Israel gets in trouble, we'll send American forces. And at the same time, to be for a $30 billion defense fund. Because over 3 years, the point is, how are you going to send the troops? Are they going to swim when you have only six carriers, including two on station? And with Greece, related to that, of course, that's a sensitive issue with our liberal friends, but nevertheless, it's there. My point is that it isn't the United States' main strength to push others around. It is the United States' main strength in order to not to be pushed around and in order to be able to play the role that only the United States can play, the role of attempting to see that these great, powerful forces, the Soviet Union is there on equal parity with the United States. China is there. It will become a significant nuclear power. So it has to be done. Japan, Europe, economic giants, with all those intentions. Now, who's going to play that role? Who's going to play it? If we don't, there's no one else in the free world that can. And only a strong United States military, a healthy United States, a strong United States economically, prosperous economically, and finally, first, but to put the other in context, because the whole point is, it begs the question to say we should change our priority. There are some who say our first priority should be our national defense and our policy abroad. And there are others who say that our first priority must be our problems at home. And the point is, you have both or you have neither. You can't be strong for you. It doesn't make any difference to have all these goodies at home if you're not able to defend them. And it doesn't do any good. And you're not going to be able to meet priorities abroad if you're weak and torn apart at home. Mm-hmm. So, therefore, we come then to the health of America's home. In order for America to play this role, it is essential that the American people, go forward on, frankly, I must say, the disappointing beginnings we've had in the field of reform. I say the disappointing. We've done a hell of a lot. The education bill, even that's a little bit to sit off the post office. But we made a few moves here. We'll have a volunteer army, for example, which isn't bad. But these are only beginnings. For the most part, whether it's welfare reform, whether it's revenue sharing, whether it's government reorganization, whether it's a new health, whether it's in any of these areas, we find that because of a recalcitrant Congress, if somebody has said that the American Revolution would happen to it, ran into an old American Congress. The difficulty is because of these things, we find that the United States still faces a very significant crisis in terms of its ability to govern. Not its ability to govern, because the machinery of government is obsolete. That's why we need reform. So now, I think going forward on reform, various reforms that we have advocated. And as we're not stuck in the mud on them. If the Congress is going to take them that way, then we'll have to find another way. But the main thing is not to be satisfied with things as they are. I think one theme you ought to get through here is this. We think we've made a good record, particularly in the field. But in every area, even in the dramatic field of foreign policy where these massive breakthroughs have occurred, the record's only beginning. And the great opportunity now is to expand the breakthroughs that we have made. The record, for example, on Seoul is the best example. Seoul, everybody has hailed and praised and rest. But even with Seoul now, Seoul today, arms still are being built. And they have to be because, and even with Seoul, both there's enough arms in the world to destroy it many times over. So we've got to move. We've got to take this promising beginning and move on to phase two, which means total limitation, and then phase three, which means eventual reduction. So it is in so many of these other fields that we made a beginning. We've got to go on. But now that's the you. Now you put in the context the kind of things you feel that ought to be emphasized, or that you want to emphasize.
Well, I just want to add to this one question. It seems to me that that you would have in your second term, if you wanted to use it, a chance to move the Republican Party into the center of American politics. For the first time, as I say, in a generation, there is a real feeling that we, the things aren't working right. Our ideas are not as good as they should be, and we better leave them. And to a surprising degree, positions of the Republican Party themselves are turning out, are being viewed with much greater effect than ever perhaps. I mean, the idea that dismissal of quotas and social quotas is against personal merit. You're very clear on
it. Let me tell you something about quotas. I put it very in terms of the White House staff. Somebody was in here the other day, saying, "Well, we like the next position on Israel, but it's because he's anti-communist." But anyway, that's better than government, he said. Somebody was saying, because he doesn't understand that we don't want American troops. We letters, one-fourth of a Kissinger is the Jewish vote in the White House. Now, that's the damn truth. Now, this business is saying, that doesn't mean anything. It's true. Look around at the Catholics. I got a professor. I got Rosewood as a Catholic. Al Haig is a Catholic. All the rest. I probably got a percentage of it. But my point is, why do I have these people? Not because they're Jews, but because they're smart. And people should come on the basis of merit. Now, I don't mean by that where people have, as has been the case, let's be very honest about it, there have been prejudices against women, there have been prejudices against young people because they're young, there have been prejudices against black because they're black, prejudices against Mexicans because they weren't squealing by it, and maybe Italians. And so you have to, I think you've got to give an edge, I'll put it that way, an edge in your selections. You've got to look harder for excellence among those groups who have not traditionally been at the top of the rung of excellence. You've got to look hard and search them out so that they have it, because that's the only way they're going to get an equal chance. But on the other hand, the idea of voters is simply going to, it's going to penalize our most able people. It's going to discourage them. And hell, what we're looking for is not equality, but excellence, as far as government is concerned. Yeah. Equal opportunity. But if you say, everybody's got to have equality, quota size, utterly un-American.
Now, this would be, it seems to me that you would be surprised in many, in certain ways, in the last 30 years, the Republican Party has not been perceived as a party of any strong guiding principle.
That's true.
And one of the main reasons is that the principles you've had have not been very popular. So you haven't been able to run out and say, we are for a free enterprise society, we are for a merit society. But the time is coming, it's cycling around. The things you've done in office and things that traditionally you've stood for are beginning to have adherence to a degree that you wouldn't have believed possible. As people begin to see what the implications of some of the other ideas are. Now, I will tell you right out one of the facts. We've got two choices in the next 4 years. Either you can articulate these and in your administration and in your relationships with the people who disseminate ideas in America, who are the most important people in America, the people who write, teach writers, and so on. Either they are articulated as Republican ideas, or the Democrats are stealing them. And you have a choice of becoming a center party, the party that controls the center, or you're going to remain a party of the interregnum. When the Democrats really back up, people say, let's try the Republicans until they get sorted out. In a certain degree, in a certain sense, that's what happened in 1968, and that's what happened in the South. But, 4 years from now, the Democrats will have taken over the South. What do you think of that?
The way I would modify it is, this is very fundamental. Very fundamental. The Republican Party, according to Kelly, has the adherence of approximately 25% of the people. Now, there's no way that a party having only 25% of the people can, in effect, make itself a majority, even if we're in the four more years.
Yeah.
Now that we got to understand. So that is why, both in the campaign and in the next administration, this is not going to be a question of first trying to have quotas as far as people are concerned, although we've done damn well with women. Because we need more women. I'm glad we've got Mrs. Whitman. She's a hell of a woman.
Yeah.
She's good looking, too. It helps. And we got that very bright person on the ADC,
very fascinating.
All the women. And of a person. But what I'm getting at is that the appointments in the next administration, people would assume that if we win a majority, which without the third party, if we win, put it this way, this would be a very interesting thing. If you're aware, except for the Johnson landslide, there hasn't been any president win a majority.
majority in this country since Franklin Roosevelt, except Eisenhower.
Yeah.
Because Kennedy was 49%.
Sure.
The party was so close. And of course, it was not true. This time, one or the other will have a majority. Right. And they'll say, well, since you've got the majority, and then you come in and reward your party and kick everybody else in the ass. I am convinced that what we need, it's going to be difficult to sell. It's going to be difficult to stay exactly the right way. I am not thinking at all in terms of so-called Republican principles.
Yeah.
Because basically, the Republican Party has its differences. They have some totally disagree with my foreign policy, and some agree with it, some totally disagree with my But what we're really talking about here is the development of a new philosophy. Mm-hmm. A new philosophy tied into this whole structure. You see, the difficulty that I see with American leadership, I must say, for this whole 70 years has been because, well, who would have been capable? T.R. did take a worldview. He was the first American president really to take a worldview.
Mm-hmm.
Wilson tried to, but he just wasn't fitting for it. It wasn't his issue. You know that I know. Wilson was an excellent first American president in terms of his investment. But, you know, he was dragged into international affairs, and then he got bitten into small little pieces by the veterans over there. Now, FDR, of course, came in with the Depression, he had the war and so forth, and he died before he could do much about it. Truman saw some of it, but it was Eisenhower had a worldview and so forth, but he didn't have a political experience and so forth. Perhaps Kennedy in too short a time. Well, without reflecting on the others, it's probably because of the times. We are now at a time when whoever is president must make policy having in mind this total mosaic. The total mosaic. In other words, my view is that a trip to Peking isn't taking for the sake of saving the forbidden city, but the trip to Peking is saving because it fits into what the world is going to be like 25 years from now. And also, that trip can't be taken unless you have in mind what your policy is doing. So, and also, unless you have in mind what you're going to do at home, everything is tied in together. It all has to do with how do you live in a more peaceful world and also a more prosperous world, which will help us be more peaceful. But also, in that context, once you have gotten those things out of the way, then you're able to concentrate your enormous talents and energies on the problems at home. Let me put it another way. Take this long, frustrating, difficult war in Vietnam. Enrich as the United States is, despite all the casualties and the rest, it is a war that has taken a lot of us in terms of men. 2010. It has cost us enormous amounts of money. And of course, it's had a massive effect on the American spirit. In other words, that's been the cost of the war. So, in terms, in other words, it's distorted our economy. It has resulted in our resources being moved too much in the area of national defense. It's also distorted our relations with other countries abroad. In my view, the most important thing that whoever sits in this office can do is to develop a policy that will avoid another Vietnam. Mm-hmm. That's why the relations with China. Because where is China? China supports Vietnam. China supported Korea. Right? We want it again. Or do we want to avoid that? Relations with Russia. See, it isn't just the big thing, the little one. But coming up, well, I digress. Let's come back to this point. What we need is to enunciate a coherent philosophy in which we foreign policy and our domestic and our economic policy and our domestic policy together into one great mosaic.
So I have a slight rumbling from any government.